Good morning, everyone. Sunday, June 21st, and here's the news reported by members of our overseas staffs. For word on events in Britain, we turn first to London and to John McVane.
This is London. Yesterday, London was wondering whether the Axis forces in Libya would try to drive against the Egyptian border or against Tobruk. Today, we found out it was Tobruk. The enemy yesterday drove at the Tobruk perimeter defenses in great strength. The defending forces put up what the official report calls determined resistance, but the Axis units cracked through and occupied a considerable area inside. There isn't any confirmation in London, but the Germans today are claiming the capture of not only Tobruk, but Bir el Gobi and Bardia. It was possible earlier in the week for observers here to get a hint that some doubt existed about British ability to hold the Tobruk perimeter defenses against a full-scale attack. That the British should send a convoy through the Mediterranean was a good indication that lack of material had become crucial. The fact that the enemy should have occupied a considerable area inside the defenses doesn't look hopeful for British ability to hold the port itself. British war correspondents with the 8th Army say that the port can be held, but Army chiefs yesterday were seriously considering whether it's worthwhile holding. They believe that if the British can organize in the next few weeks for a counteroffensive, Tobruk would be worth hanging on to. If not, they say, the price in men, ships, and material would be too great. There'll be a lot of questions asked in Britain about this campaign. Auchinleck had been building up his supplies over a period of months, but he evidently didn't have enough of the right kind of weapons. The defenders of Bir Hakeim said the thing that contributed most to the loss of that key point was German dive bombers. It's been officially stated that the RAF had air superiority in the desert. Scrutator of the London Sunday Times today says that aircraft of a type so deadly and yet so vulnerable were allowed to operate so long against such a vital strong point with relatively so little interference suggests that our margin of fighter superiority was too low. Scrutator notes significantly, meanwhile, we ourselves had no dive bombers, and the ordinary precision bombing to which we were restricted, while it rendered valuable services against the enemy's supply columns, proved ill-adapted, as it had in the winter, either to stop his tanks or overcome his strong points. As you probably know, the attitude in the RAF's top strata is that the war can be won by bombing alone, if only the bombing raids are big and continuous enough. In view of what Rommel was able to do against a force that did have air superiority, you can only hope that American air chiefs, when they help plan a campaign, will realize that air power, with all its strength, has its shortcomings as well. If there's been one lesson this war should have taught, it is that land power or air power or sea power don't mean much used alone. And at least one observer of war can hope that American Army leaders, when the time comes, will teach not only the RAF, but the Luftwaffe what real Army cooperation between tank and plane can mean in striking power. Thinking over the Second Front and possible new theaters of war, you can hope we'll make full use of our sympathizers inside Axis-controlled territories. French colonials who would fight off British or Americans as foreign invaders might well join a force accompanied by de Gaulle's Frenchmen. 400 crack colonial infantry officers and men from Madagascar have just done that. An officer is quoted as saying, we heard about Bir Hakeim, and that was enough. If Italian-speaking Americans were used to land in Italy, they might raise support that would help us and harm the Axis. In any other part of the continent, there's little doubt that the national army of the country will form part of the vanguard. The Norwegians in Norway, Dutch troops in Holland, or Sikorsky's men in Poland. Today's London papers play up news that American soldiers are stationed in Britain itself. And the failure in Libya, coupled with the talks between President Roosevelt and Mr. Churchill, seems to have given the British the idea that we must act soon, somewhere, to retrieve our positions. A strong force of British bombers last night made another attack on Emden in northwest Germany. Airdromes in Holland were raided, and coastal command planes bombed shipping off the Dutch coast. The British lost 7 aircraft. This is John McVane in London, returning you to New York.
Over the Atlantic again, this time to Sweden. David Anderson reports from Stockholm.
Hello, New York. This is David Anderson speaking from Stockholm. An hour ago, the German High Command announced that the Germans and Italians have occupied Tobruk, Bardia, and El Gobi. There are few facts available as yet concerning the capitulation, but the Germans say that the British had sent out a negotiator to inform them of the British intention to capitulate. It is also unknown if the surrender was unconditional. With regard to the occupation of Tobruk, The Germans say that both the fortification and port were occupied and that 25,000 prisoners were taken, among them several generals. They say, though, that the amount of equipment taken cannot be estimated as yet. With regard to the continued military operations, the Germans report that they are now chasing the retiring British toward the Egyptian frontier. The changed tactics of General Rommel during the past 48 hours is thought to have brought Tobruk into a very precarious situation. It was, as you know, in circles with few chances of breaking through the German and Italian ring. The sea route was the only doubtful means of escape. But there have even been British indications during the past couple of days that General Ritchie might not intend to hold Tobruk. Reports from London had pointed out that the job of supplying Tobruk this time was infinitely more difficult, with Italian motor torpedo boats and land-based German aircraft within easy reach of Tobruk and her supply lines. From here today, it appears as though General Ritchie is retiring to better fortified positions at Solom and on the Halfaya Pass. Meanwhile, we can't forget that at 5 o'clock tomorrow morning, it will have been exactly 1 year since the Germans began their so-called crusade against Bolshevism. This time of year is always one of increased tension in this part of the world, and this tension does not appear to be any less this year. But most of this tension is indirectly connected with a promised German summer offensive. Where will it begin and when will it begin? Wherever it begins, that spirit of complacency which the Swedes may have been accused of showing earlier is not one which is prevalent today. This is David Anderson returning you now to New York.
Developments in the Pacific Theater of War are next reported to us through the newsroom in San Francisco.
And now for the report from the American forces in the Southwest Pacific, we hear the report from New Zealand.
Zealand, 1:07 a.m., Monday. Since I last spoke to you, married men with children between the ages of 32 and 34 have been called up for military service. The latest conscripts, as well as those previously called, are liable for service in... the Army. In such branches as will relieve men for more active positions. Batteries in the same capacities as the women in AA outfits in Britain. Rubber
We regret that our signal from New Zealand is not sufficiently good enough to continue our broadcast, but here are some bulletins from the newsroom in San Francisco. More Japanese docks, airport runways, and bombers lie in blackened, twisted ruins today after two heavy bombing raids by Allied squadrons. Our flyers roared for hundreds of miles over the tide-swept tropical sea lanes above Australia to stab quickly and effectively at two of the Mikado's chief invasion bases, Rabaul and Lae. At Rabaul on New Britain Island, far to the northeast of Australia, MacArthur's bombers blasted wharves and other harbor targets in a highly successful night attack. And far to the southwest, on the big fever-ridden cannibal island of New Guinea, other Allied bombers plastered an airdrome at Lae, demolishing two Japanese bombers on the ground. Lae is across New Guinea from the strategic Allied harbor of Port Moresby, and it was from Lae that Jap land forces twice drove inland up the heavily jungled Markham Valley, presumably to feel out the possibilities of taking Moresby by land. Devastating floods caused the Japs to give up the invasion attempt. MacArthur's latest communique says zero planes took part in trying to defend Rabaul and Lae from the new bombing attacks, but the enemy's fighter defenses were not effective, and no Allied plane losses are announced. Far to the west, in waters now almost completely dominated by warships flying the rising sun, three big Japanese vessels have been sent to the bottom by British submarines. They went down in the shark-ridden waters of Malacca Strait, the narrow channel separating Malaya and Sumatra. The date of the sinkings has not been disclosed, but they bring the total of Japanese vessels destroyed in the Pacific area to at least 291. This recapitulation includes Jap vessels of all classifications sent to the bottom since hostilities broke out in the Pacific more than 6 months ago. Japanese invaders in the Aleutian Islands are getting smacked whenever there is a rift in the fog banks. Those are the exact words of an official spokesman for the 13th Naval District in Seattle, Washington. The mystery of the Aleutian battle, he says, is merely a mystery of weather, plus a desire to keep the enemy in the dark. He remarks that if Americans are confused about the North Pacific fight, then so are the Japs, and that's all to the good. The naval spokesman adds that there won't be a statement on the battle until the battle is decided. And that's the news from the San Francisco newsroom. And now to the newsroom in New York.
For a report on developments on the domestic scene, we turn now to our nation's capital.
Although it has been emphatically rejected by the House Ways and Means Committee, the sales tax proposal is by no means dead. This is the opinion of many capital observers who look for the general sales levy to make its appearance as a separate measure after the fall elections. The House group completed the new tax bill yesterday, but left it more than $2 billion short of what the Treasury has been asking for. Proponents of the sales levy contend that it would raise many times this sum, and they point to the fact that this is an election year when seeking a reason for the defeat of their scheme. After all, they contend, the country is ready to make any necessary sacrifices in order to win the war. But the old idea of not raising taxes when there is an election in the offing seems to be a little too strong in the minds of many legislators. But they continue, as soon as the elections are out of the way, many members who are hesitant about levying a general sales tax will be only too eager to adopt it in order to give the federal coffers every penny of revenue which they require. And if this means a sales tax, then a sales tax it shall be. In the meantime, as the new tax bill now stands, it will provide $6.640 million, and it will bite into your paycheck and take a percentage of it for the payment of taxes. These deductions, which are strongly advocated by many economists, will start on January 1st. Nevertheless, there are many here in the Capitol who contend that the tax bill, as it will appear on the House floor, will not bear any resemblance to the bill, which will finally be written into law. True, the Constitution requires that any revenue-raising measure must originate on the floor of the lower body of Congress. But there is nothing to prevent the Senate from rewriting a tax bill after it has been presented by the House. And despite the lengthy sessions which the Ways and Means Committee has held, there are many veteran Capitol Hill observers who firmly believe that when the Senate gets through writing its version of the revenue measure, it'll be a great deal different than it is now. Already there are many senators who disapprove of the tentative draft of the bill, which will be presented to the House. And there are any number of little blocks which will present their own taxation theories once they are given an opportunity. In the meantime, Washington, like the rest of the country, is busy with its speculations as to just what President Roosevelt and Prime Minister Churchill are talking about. Advance indications were that the historic conferences would be brief and that a statement would be forthcoming after Mr. Churchill has returned to London. Just when that will be, of course, there is no way of knowing, but rumor, and Washington is full of rumor these days, has it that such an announcement might be made either today or tomorrow. And here's a bit of news for war workers who are desperately in need of new tires. The Office of Price Administration has amended the tire rationing regulations so that workers in the larger war plants may obtain new second-grade tires. The OPA says that these who qualify must be permanent employees who are participating in a carpooling plan, and it hints that committees may be formed in essential plants to select qualified applicants. And so for the moment, that's all from Washington.
These have been reports by John McVane from London and David Anderson from Stockholm. For the latest news, keep tuned to this station. This is the National Broadcasting Company.